It's great to be with you. This is a little weird being back here. I feel like a foreign exchange student. It really is, though. It's a pleasure to be with you, and also it's an honor to be asked to do this. So I hope that what I end up offering you, let's hope the juice is worth the squeeze, so to speak. I'm going to start off with a little family update real fast. That's Dax and Bodie and Shepherd. And so they are representative of the biggest change in our lives. And some of you can probably relate to that. But it's been a great experience. And what I wanted to tell you was that what I see in them and what the potential is in their lives to a large degree started here. So, thank you. Because you were a part of it. All right. There is a perplexing sort of incongruity at work here that you would ask a white guy in his 60s to talk to you about speaking to a modern day audience. It's a head scratcher, a bald head scratcher at that. Several years ago at the National Prayer Breakfast, Bono from U2 was asked to speak. And by the way, I thought he did actually a very thoughtful presentation. But he acknowledged the oddness of having a rock star address that audience. He turned to President Bush and he began by asking, "Mr. President, are you sure this is a good idea? Austin, are you sure this is a good idea?" In 1985, the country duo The Judds sang, "Grandpa, tell me about the good old days. Sometimes it feels like the world's gone crazy. Take me back to yesterday, when the line between right and wrong didn't seem so hazy. Did lovers really fall in love to stay and stand beside each other, come what may? Was a promise really something kept, not just something they would say? Did families really bow their heads to pray? Did daddies really never go away? Grandpa, tell me about the good old days." Most leaders would agree. Over the past few years, leadership challenges have gotten harder and harder and harder. Seemingly impossible. Expectations by employees have changed. Cultural differences seem more profound today. In many ways, what leaders of organizations face today is what we see on a broader scale in society at large. More stress, more anxiety, more anger, less trust, less patience, less tolerance. We seem to have a greater cultural divide today, perhaps, than ever. We have cancel culture, trigger happy emotions, and also our differences run along different lines, whether they're ethnic, racial, political, geographic, any number of differences or distinctions that we may identify. We hear a lot about diversity these days. And the word diversity itself can be a triggering word for a lot of people, maybe for you. But I want to urge you to not get all sweaty and triggered by it. Because the picture that is painted in the New Testament church is one that was and should be distinct in its diversity. Jesus talked about making disciples of all nations. And the word he used there is ethnos. It's where we get ethnic groups. Paul wrote to the Corinthian church about diversity. And he used a metaphor about the body that you're very familiar with, about its diverse parts, noting that how those parts are different, many of them very different, but vital to the body. James challenges us to avoid even the appearance of partiality. Welcoming the one with the not so clean or appealing clothes, not to sit at the back, but to sit with the rich folks. But does our body language say something else? Our lips don't say sit at the back, but how about our body language? Or have you considered all that God has to say about the treatment of foreigners? Extending hospitality to people who are really different, from a different place, from a different background. Our God gently but firmly reminds us, you too were foreigners, and I welcomed you in. I protected you. Are we welcoming? I know we say the right things. You know, for the most part as a group, I think we are. So much so, we practically tackle a visitor who walks in the door. But let's face it, we live in an increasingly diverse world, especially in the spiritual realm. With those differences comes greater challenges for us to truly have eyes that truly see, to have ears that hear. It's hard work, and it's selfless. Today, I want to visit with you about an often overlooked area of diversity, age. When we examine the data regarding the differences we see in culture today, many of the disagreements, many of the differences run along generational lines. Now, generation gaps have always existed. And by the way, by putting up this image, I fully realize the irony of showing you something that only people of a certain age would even figure out. I dare say that all of us have been frustrated by an older generation whose views on some aspects of life seem very different than ours. And that's in the Lord's church, where we make respect of elders and the old paths a priority. Even still, I know there are times when I look to the older generations with a sense of frustration about what seems to be their stuckness in areas of life. And then I watch a Progressive commercial and I realize I'm the one the younger people are making fun of. In this study, I want to emphasize, I'm talking to myself. I can be the old stay off my lawn guy. I found this quote from a grumpy old guy. Children now love luxury. They have bad manners, contempt for authority. They show disrespect for elders. They love meaningless chatter. Children are now tyrants, not the servants of households. They no longer rise when elders come in the room. They contradict their parents. They tyrannize their teachers. Sound familiar? Socrates said that about 2,500 years ago. Now, there are differences today. It's trickier. Like many of the aspects of society, I would suggest that technology changes have helped speed up, broaden, and exacerbate the generational differences that have always been evident in the life cycles of man. Social scientists agree. The changes today are not only more extensive, but they're more profound, and they're coming faster. And so it makes the divide even trickier to navigate. Technology and electronic connectedness have also created subcultures, which means even more divisions. Now, the term generation gap was coined in the 1960s. Favorite story. Teenager goes to his dad and says, you know, Dad, it's time that we start thinking about a car for me. Dad says, you know, I don't really disagree. I think so, too. But there's some things that got to change first. He says, oh, okay, well, what do you want changed? He says, well, a car is a big responsibility, so He said, all right. He says, number one, you need better grades. I don't want to see any more C's. Number two, you need to get a job. Car is an expensive thing to operate, and you need to show some financial responsibility. Number three, get a haircut. A few months goes by, young man comes back. Dad, let's talk about that car again. Okay. Dad, my grades are up dramatically. He said, I know, I've seen it. That's phenomenal. He said, and also I've got the job at the hardware store and I'm saving some money. He said, I know, I'm really proud of you on that. He said, so Dad, you know, how about that car? And he says, how about that haircut? Well, Dad, I looked at some pictures in that Bible you gave me, pictures of Jesus, and he had hair even longer than I did. His dad said, yeah, and he walked everywhere too. My assignment is to consider how we best communicate with younger generations, specifically regarding the gospel of Jesus Christ. And I feel woefully inadequate to do it. I have, however, spent a lot of time reading and listening and trying to learn about the characteristics of different generations. I've had to do it in business. And of course, we got kids and grandkids. So today I want to relay some information, use a couple of Bible stories, maybe give some insights, a couple of thoughts and observations for you to think about and discuss. By the way, what I'm going to say is the opinions of this guy. They do not necessarily represent those of management. I want to tickle your curiosity and your creative thought about how we interact and teach and guide our young people in the church, and also young people out there who we may want to reach with the greatest offer ever made, the gospel. To think about how we might more effectively and also intentionally pursue capturing their hearts, the hearts of young people today who need assurance and they need encouragement as they try to navigate turbulent waters of society and career and culture and family as they grow in the Lord. How do we encourage discipleship, particularly with those who seem very different from us in many ways? And yet they face challenges that are truly daunting. Sometimes, though, not so different than the ones we faced. I mentioned diversity. I want to open your eyes to this not so obvious area of age diversity, which I think is a huge opportunity for the kingdom. Jesus came and spoke to them, saying, all authority has been given to me in heaven and earth. Go therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all things that I have commanded you. And lo, I'm with you always, even to the end of the age. Our Lord gave us a mission statement, and my summation is to make and grow followers of King Jesus, so that more and more we and those we influence might be fruitful image bearers of the King. Our love for God demands that we be obedient to that directive. As John challenges us in 1 John 4:20, a professed love for God carries with it an obligation to love people. And biblical love requires an investment, a sacrifice. And so a consistent and sometimes frustrating biblical theme is often the depth of our love for God is evidenced in how we love people. But people like sheep smell. And one of the strongest odors to get over is how different they are from us. It creates a huge challenge to achieve alignment in a church, a family, an organization, where people are so different. And along comes Paul, one of the early adopters of diversity. 1 Corinthians 12, Paul gives us a metaphor, and he relates the diversity of the church to body parts. And he hints at the potential challenges in a church of relating some to some body parts that are different. Some parts of the body that seem weakest and least important are actually the most necessary. And the parts we regard as less honorable are those we clothe with the greatest care. And boy, are there some different body parts today. Spoiler alert. Abiding in Christ is important. It's a key component to how we navigate our teaching, our leadership challenges, particularly when we are dealing with those who view life through a very different lens. Remember, our objective is to help people become more like Jesus, not more like us. To the degree that there's an overlap, awesome. We're being formed day by day, so here's a quick sidebar. Take a break from Fox News or CNN or whatever your flavor of news is. Take a break from the anger and the rancor and the hate on social media. We're being formed. And therefore, our teaching and our guiding of sheep is being impacted by what we consume. We are what we eat. And some of us are taking in too much junk food. Some, it's political porn. And they're addicted. When we poison our spirit with a cloud of disdain and discouragement, we inadvertently sow seeds of fear rather than modeling a life that is eternally productive and hopeful. And would anybody argue that in the world today, especially with our young people, we could use a message of less fear and more hope? Okay, back to our regularly scheduled program. Let me share with you some information about diversity, and I have got to hustle along here. It's not something that usually gets lumped in to the diversity discussion, but it should. And I'm not, by lumping it in, trying to make things more complicated. As a matter of fact, I think in some ways, more awareness makes it less complicated. And I think age differences in the way our generations have formed is worth noting. People are living longer today. For the first time, seven generations are around. That's when you count the very young and those who are over 95. You might even see that in congregations today. Possibly you got five generations. Almost absolutely for sure, you probably have three or four. Never before have this many generations been together in a church or a workplace. So I'm going to remind you of the generation here. The builder or silent generation, 77 to 94. We hear of the greatest generation. Those are people over 95. The boomers, I'm one, 58 to 77. Generation X are the busters when the birth rate dropped. That was the same time Roe v. Wade came along. It was the same time that a lot of other cultural issues, divorce rate was higher, and so on. Then millennials, 23 to 40, the dreaded millennials. And the coronials, as they're now being called, Gen Z, 8 to 23. It occurred to me, our four-year-old grandson, Dax, spent his first 2 years looking at people with masks on, which may explain his fascination with Spider-Man. My friend Tim Elmore has spent a career studying this stuff. and he works with John Maxwell. One of his latest books is a new kind of diversity. I've stolen a lot of stuff out of it. It's a very thought-provoking book, so much so that if you'll sign up, I'm going to send you a free copy. Some of the observations of these generational differences, too, I want to show you that. So, I'm not going to go through this whole thing. It's in the book, so you can see it. But I think there's a couple of things that are really worth noting. And I wasn't supposed to do this, so please don't post this. Please. Okay, life paradigm, and you've probably seen this with people who are in the builders. Be grateful you got a job. And turn the lights off. What do you think we're doing around here? You think we're trying to air condition the whole neighborhood? I want to do better. There's got to be more out there. That was my deal. The busters came along and said, keep it real. It ain't that good. Sounds like a nice story, but I ain't buying it. Millennials, life is a cafeteria. Here's the scary one, guys. I'm hoping and coping. So when I talk about the need to be encouraging and paint a pathway of hope, that's what I'm talking about. And we see it all the time. Numbers of mental health, other issues, suicide, you name it. You go down the list, and it's a factor. And I think our preaching, our teaching, our guiding and mentoring has got to deal with that. Now, there's a whole bunch of other stuff that you can look at here. I was going to talk about, real quick, view of authority. The older folks, respect them. We came along and said, replace them. Endure them. Choose them. I don't think I need them. I have Google. It's a different world. It highlights the need to learn about and understand and better interact the people we want to influence, to understand where they're coming from and what's their vantage point. From a spiritual perspective, I'm sorry, I was going to show you real quick. This is the workforce for 2025. And you can see where it's landing. Silent generation is pretty much out of the mix right now. But you can see the same challenges that exist in the church of working together across generational lines. If you're running a business, you already know this. A friend of mine used to run WGN in Chicago, and he referred to not just this, but he always talked about the minefield slalom was never our best event. This is the minefield slalom. And you can see how the different groups line up. Okay, I want to show you this real quick. 18 to 25-year-olds who engage in certain religious activities. Okay? This is like once a month. You can see what's happened. Whether the Bible is an inspired word, if they ever pray, ever go to religious services, affiliate with any religion, even believe in God. It's a different world. And you can see particularly what's happened in here the last few years around COVID time. It basically fell off the map. 12th graders who attend religious services once a month or more. I don't know why they did this, but they divided it into race. But you can see it's a different thing than what it was. I mean, look back here. In the 70s and the 80s, we were bouncing along here at a pretty high percentage, a percentage that we think would be amazing today. So it's different. When we see data like this, I want to emphasize it's really important to not look at something like this or the one before it and go, Well, no wonder. These kids these days. And I'll admit, I'm guilty of that sometimes. And then I remember a couple of things. Older people said the same thing about me. And I'm also reminded of the time I met Tim. He was outlining these differences in generations. And he was doing it at an event our company was sponsoring. He was showing coaches and athletic administrators what they might be dealing with and what they need to understand to best coach and teach and motivate young people. Tim quickly added, "Hey, if there's something about the younger generations you see that you really don't like, you need to remember something. Those are your kids. You did it. It's your fault." So, what are we doing to establish the course for our young people? What are the things that we can be doing? What are the things that they need? What are the stories that they need to have embedded? I'm reminded of Joshua, the instruction that God gave him to establish a mile marker of sorts, to note God's power and faithfulness to deliver. Through Joshua, God commanded each tribe to take a stone from the Jordan and build a memorial. You know the story. Then Joshua said to the Israelites, "In the future, your children will ask, what do these stones mean?" And then you can tell them. So, what are we doing with our story? What are the mile markers that we're placing out there that are opportunities to tell and retell the greatest story ever told? Former Missouri governor and senator John Ashcroft used to say, "The obligation of any society is the transmission of its most important values from one generation to the next." I think we can agree we have a similar obligation in the church. For those who are growing up in the church and those who God will add to his family in the future. It's hard, sacrificial work. So what do we do? So I got some suggestions, and I'll tell you, it's about time. How we utilize what God has given us in terms of time is the most important investment we can make, and it's an acronym. The first one is teaching. I'm probably going to step on some toes here, including my own. We got to keep working on our teaching. The gospel is not boring. But boy, we can make it that way sometimes. We can do better. And we need to. Lessons that lack enthusiasm, lessons that are way too long, as I'm probably going over my time, do not do justice to the greatest story ever told. I'm not saying that you develop your teaching to serve itching ears. There are times we got to hit some hard stuff. But people today, just like the people who were addressed in the book of Hebrews, need encouragement. They need to be emboldened to deal with a challenging culture. They need to be equipped and they need to be enabled to live a life of joyful service, which is incredibly attractive to young people and old people, inside and outside the body of Christ. There's no other place that they will see and experience that. And we need to be enthusiastic about that message. Many of you are incredible scholars of the Bible. Be careful that your lessons don't go so deep into particular nuances that we fail to tell the big story. The story of redemption that leads to a life that is fueled by a hopeful expectation. Sometimes we tend to offer a lot of information that's interesting to us. And that's about where it stops. In our lessons, we have to ask ourselves, is this valuable to the lives of the people I'm talking to? Or am I just trying to show that I know something? We have to consider the realities of our time, not the realities of a religious world from a book of sermon outlines from 1958. Yes, there are doctrinal issues that need to be addressed and supported. I would argue there's a time and a place for that. But we've got to be wise about how we do that and when we do it. Sometimes we take on fights nobody's fighting. Sometimes I get the feeling that we dive into topics assuming people are going to disagree. So we end up condemning instead of enlightening. As data shows, most of the people we encounter don't know squat about the Bible, much less the Restoration Movement. But they do know something's missing from their lives. In Acts 17, Paul was absolutely masterful in the way that he complimented the people of Athens for their religious vigor. He said, "There is a God that you don't know. He's unknown to you, but I want to introduce him to you." He could have attacked them regarding their stupid idols. But he sat in the marketplace, he watched and he listened. And I think there's a lesson in there for us. As the data shows, and as I've witnessed from talking to lots of people, particularly young people today, they're fearful and they're uninformed. They need to be known. They need to be cared for, even those who occupy our pews. Consider the way Jesus taught. Simple stories, powerful message. Powerful message about God's love, his plan for our lives. Very few occasions that he spent a lot of time dissecting words. We all have powerful stories to tell. We need to read before we lead, before we teach. Take the time to know where somebody is. Jesus was, not surprisingly, master at this. It's dangerous to make assumptions, but we got to read before we lead. The story of Jesus is factual. We stress that, but it's also emotional and it's personal. In response to the churches who are all emotion, we have a tendency to suck the emotion out of it. Research tells us that most decisions that we make in life are actually emotionally driven, like 70-80% of them. And then we reverse engineer them to being logical. I was raised in the Christian church, baptized at an early in my teenage years. And I would tell you that I was a believer. That's about where it ended. Then, I was pretty sure I wasn't going to do this. My sophomore year, I met Shari. Started to come, and it was weird. Saved my life. And it made my life. Now, you think there's not some emotion in it? At a meeting with Dennis Smith here in Columbia, Sunday afternoon, we went to play softball at the park. That did it. I was baptized that night, right there. It wasn't the softball. I really don't even like softball. I don't like baseball either. But I felt loved and known. Dennis sought me out. Not as Preacher Dennis, but as a guy who seemed genuinely interested in me. And he acted normal. Afterwards, Bill met me outside and said, "I'm always here if you need me." That was 40 years ago. Connection was made. I didn't just hear the gospel. I experienced it. You don't think there's some emotion in that? Okay, intentionality. We have to be intentional about reaching out. We tend to stay in our own circle. Don't get me wrong, relationships in the church matter greatly, but being connected is a must. Connecting with young people inside and outside the church, in my opinion, is the secret sauce. Not to prove that we're right, but to prove we care. To spend time in an intentional way, not just in a Bible study. Sure, that could and should be a major part of it eventually, but connect to know them. Spend time with them, invest, do the heavy lifting. One-on-one, be curious about them. I find that hospitality is an amazing tool. When people my age invite young people, married or single, over for an evening, magic happens. Often they're amazed that you'd actually spend time with them. I've found that they're hungry for that kind of caring interest and attention. To get them to tell their story, to share their struggle, there are always opportunities to share wisdom they either didn't get or weren't offered by their parents or others, but they're fearful and they're often lonely. And it can be a joyful experience for you to do it. But we have to make time. Start by inviting them to your house. Tell them you're going to make pizza and everybody works at it. It doesn't have to be fancy. Understand, though, quite likely what is missing from their lives is the spirit of stability that they will immediately sense when they walk in your house. Because it's missing. And you take it for granted. So do I. In the course of being intentional and investing in them, getting to know them, the Lord will open a door. The objective should be to get to know them, not convince them of something. Jesus cared deeply about the people he encountered first, and then he taught them. And the people felt it. It'll take some courage, but we got to get out of what Tim calls our peer ghetto. Hanging around people who are just like us, because it's comfortable. All right, got to move. Mentoring. In his book, Tim offers a terrific word picture, guide dogs and guard dogs. Guard dogs protect and they use fear. Not the most welcoming or inviting. They have no interest in engaging relationally. Guide dogs also protect, but from a selfless vantage point. They lead the blind and they do it sacrificially. They relate, they look for, on behalf of those they are leading, dangers and opportunities. Young people need guide dogs today. Some of us old dogs need to be better guide dogs. Young people are blind to many of the dangers, but also a lot of the opportunities that are available in Christ, but it takes time and it takes patience. Which, by the way, is what God offered us through Jesus. Patience and guidance. And in the mentoring process, you might just be given the opportunity to show and tell why your life is distinctive and different. but it'll be by invitation instead of a drive-by shooting. Enthusiasm. We got enough grumpiness and enough complaining in the world to last us. One of the distinctive traits that we can impress upon people, especially young people who need encouragement, is that a life in Jesus is full of hope and energy. A repentant life is one that has a joyful expectation. We need more of that in the world today. And get this, we are uniquely enabled to do it. When you can exhibit a living hope, it's contagious. Imagine you miss a ball game. Your favorite team is playing, so you record it to watch it later. But on the way home, your buddy calls and tells you what a great win it was. Ugh. But you still want to see the game. Don't you watch the game differently? The penalties, the drop balls, they don't get you all, you know, angry, throwing shoes at the TV. Because you know who wins. Don't we know and don't we believe that our team wins? And therefore, shouldn't it impact the way we play the game? The way we talk about the game? The way we experience bumps in the road in the game? The way we deal with hardship? The way we deal with frustrations? We win! The question is, do we believe that? And if we do, shouldn't it be showing up? Hebrews 11, now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. For it, by it, the elders obtained a good testimony, a great story worth repeating. Enthusiasm in teaching, singing, and so on. Ask yourself, if someone came in here, would they want to join up? Is it the kind of experience that they can't get out of their heads? Is it the kind of feeling that they can't really describe, but they just know they're home? We can do better. I'm going to buzz through this. I got one last thing I'm going to hit you with, okay? So Jesus gives us an example. All right? You know the story, John. It's well known, this story in John 4. Jesus had to go through Samaria. Didn't have to, but he did. Jesus took a side trip. It was intentional. It wasn't convenient. It wasn't even safe. He worked extra hard to have an encounter. He was willing to enter foreign territory. We tend to hang around people we agree with. We get stuck in our peer ghetto. That's dangerous. Even the disciples were scratching their heads about this. We have to be intentional. We got to take a risk. We have to rely on influence over authority. Because when you have influence, you have authority. I talk to young people about this all the time because they want the next title. They want to move up. And so the question for them is, what are you doing to have influence? Because if you're good at influence, you'll naturally be good at authority. Jesus was tired from a long walk. He sat wearily beside the well at noontime. He was tired. And he asked for a drink. He was willing to ask for help. Younger generations want to use their gifts. And they have them. We need to ask for their help. And when we ask for help, we prime the pump. It's humble, it's sacrificial, it's vulnerable. Because guess what? They might screw it up. Just like we did. It demonstrates how important they are to us and to God. Okay, the woman was surprised. For Jews refused to have anything to do with the Samaritans. You're a leader, you're a preacher, you're an elder, and you're asking for me to help you? You're asking for help? Tim talks about this in his book, and he refers to it as reverse mentoring. Listen to them. Studies show that listening deeply is interpreted as love, so much so that listening and love are practically indistinguishable. We engage by listening, and it gives us a chance to read before we lead. And that opens the door to mentoring younger generations in a kind way. Look at what Jesus did on purpose. He pursued one who had a different agenda in life, a different set of values, vastly different lifestyle. Jesus could know all things, so he knew this woman. We got to take time to get to know. Read before we lead. Jesus replied, if you only knew the gift that God has for you and who you were speaking to, you'd ask me for living water. So some back and forth happens. Jesus does some teaching. But what's our mindset? What's our objective? Efficiency? Winning the argument? Exercising authority? We have to think about our motives. Guide dogs, not guard dogs. Jesus replied, anyone who drinks this water will soon become thirsty again. Words of life. Words of wisdom, insight, advice, counsel. The door got opened. And it sets the stage for influence and caring authority. Jesus approached her with humility, but he didn't abandon his authority. We can be gentle and firm at the same time. Soft heart, firm foundation. She says, please give me this water. Awesome. She went from being suspicious of Jesus to asking him for help and guidance. Go get your husband, he tells her. And then he tells her some other stuff about her. Jesus spoke from supernatural insight. We today can speak from a vantage point of being in the Spirit. We can speak from experiences. I know the challenges you're facing. I faced them too. They might say, are you a prophet? How did you know? Wisdom, experience in a generous way. Just about done. So tell me, why is it you Jews insist on Jerusalem? She asks a question. She opens the door. Tells me that Jesus presented himself in a way that made it easy for her to trust him. We can't lose that. It was a safe place. The woman says, I know the Messiah is coming. Jesus says, I'm the Messiah. Think about the magnitude. You've seen The Chosen. I love this scene. She says, I'm going to go tell everybody. And he chuckles and says, I was counting on it. The woman left her jar. This is applicable for us. Meanwhile, the disciples, because they will come streaming. the message will get around. Jesus replies, I have the kind of food you know nothing about. Joy. And we have the same opportunity for the same thing. So what do? It's an investment of time. And it's about time.